Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I want to welcome you to the Tattered Cover at Colfax. I'm Kathy Langer. I'm the lead buyer for the Tattered Cover, and just thrilled to see so many of you out here tonight, and we appreciate your support of the Tattered Cover and independent businesses in general. It really makes a difference to our community and to the book world in general. Tonight we have a special guest here to introduce our author. I'm sure many of you will recognize David Milofsky, whether by having read his thoughtful columns in the Denver Post about books and publishing over many years, or perhaps you know him as the founder, one of the founders of the Evil Companions Literary Awards, or maybe you're a fan of his novels, Playing from Memory and A Friend of Kissinger, just to name a couple of them. And surely some of you enjoyed the offerings of the Denver Quarterly when he was editor for many years. And perhaps even some of you have had the privilege of partaking of his wisdom. He's an English professor at CSU, so maybe you know him that way. And maybe you have checked none of the above, but I'd love it for you to join me in welcoming David Milofsky.
The best introductions are always embarrassing, so thank you, Kathy. I think you'll all be happy to know that Richard's book, Canada, just made number 8 on the New York Times bestsellers list. So, with your help, it will rise higher. So, the books are for sale. I first met Richard Ford in the summer of 1976 at the Breadloaf Writers Conference in Middlebury, Vermont. It was a daunting lineup that summer, especially for a neophyte like me. On the faculty were John Gardner, George P. Eliot, and Stanley Elkin, joined by poets Howard Nemiroff, Bill Meredith, and Maxine Kuman, among others. A young John Irving was there, working on an unpublished novel that would become the world according to Garp. And among the fledgling writers were Tim O'Brien, who was about to publish Going After Cacciato, Terence Day Prey, who had just published The Survivor, his brilliant study of the Holocaust, Linda Pastin, and Ron Hanson. I was there on a scholarship and was green as new corn in literary matters, having just come out from the Midwest. I thought in advance was a romantic gesture, that a floor was something you walked on, and a galley, a place reserved for slaves in ancient epics like the Odyssey. But naive as I was, I could sense that even in that literary constellation, Richard, who was about to publish his first novel, was special. I hasten to add that this didn't take a great deal of insight, since everyone on the mountain shared this opinion. Richard's talent then, as now, was large, obvious, and undeniable. Needless to say, history has proven us all right. The fact that Richard and his beautiful wife, Christina, were tall and elegant, had faultless manners, and were unfailingly gracious to others could conceivably, with other people, have contributed to this impression. Dayenu, as we say in Hebrew, that might have been enough. But there's more, much more. As a writer, Richard could and can do it all. His writing can be sensuous and lyrical, as in his first book, A Piece of My Heart, elegiac, as particularly in the Bascombe novels, tender, as in his depiction of the young Del Parsons in Canada, having been set adrift by his bank-robbing parents. But Richard's writing can also be hard-boiled and graphic, as in The Ultimate Good Luck, and in the incredible scene of the new novel when Del describes a cold-blooded murder that's over in seconds. Richard knows what words mean, and he makes his words count, all of them. So Dayenu, that should be enough for anyone. And this introduction is, no doubt, more than enough for all of you. But I'd be remiss if I didn't also say that among Richard's many talents is that he's a great friend, loyal and considerate and always willing to help. It's wonderful to have him here tonight to celebrate the publication of this terrific new novel. So please help me welcome Richard Ford back to Denver.
Thank you very much, David. Takes two to make a friendship, that's for sure. And thank you all so much for coming tonight. The tattered cover, I sometimes go home at night and think that I'm coming back to the tattered cover. I've been here lots of times, never enough. I know what a precious institution the tattered cover is in this city, but it's as precious an institution for those of us who depend, as we do, on independent booksellers, that without which none of us would be thriving today to the extent that we are, particularly in rough seas in the publishing world. So thanks to the tattered cover, and thanks to you all. What I think I'll do is read you the beginning of this book, because then that, if I read the beginning, that I don't have to do all the blah, blah, blah and tell you all about things, who people are and what you need to know before the part I'm going to read is, and leave you hanging in the middle of something so that you go away saying, I don't really like that book very much. I mean, if you can't read the beginning and make it make sense, you're really in trouble. After which we'll, if you want, I'll be happy to talk to you about questions. First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murders which happened later. The robbery is the more important part, since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the courses they eventually followed. Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did. They were just regular. Although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank. My father, Dell Parsons, was a country boy born in Marengo County, Alabama in 1923, and came out of high school in 1939, burning to be in the Army Air Corps, the branch that became the Air Force. He went in Demopolis, trained at Randolph near San Antonio, longed to be a fighter pilot, but lacked the aptitude, and so learned bombardiering instead. He flew the B-25s, the light and medium Mitchells that were seeing duty in the Philippines and later over Osaka, where they rained destruction on the earth, both on the enemy and undeserving people alike. He was a tall, winning, smiling, handsome six-footer. He barely fitted into his bombardier's compartment, with a big, square, expectant face and knobby cheekbones and sensuous lips and long, attractive feminine eyelashes. He had white, shiny teeth and a short black hair he was proud of, as he was of his name, Bev. Captain Bev Parsons. He never conceded that Beverly was a woman's name in most people's minds. It grew from Anglo-Saxon roots, he said. It's a common name in England. Vivian, Gwen, and Shirley are men's names there. No one confuses them with women. He was a nonstop talker, was open-minded for a Southerner, had graceful, obliging manners that should have taken him far in the Air Force, but didn't. His quick hazel eyes would search around any room he was in, finding someone to pay attention to him, my sister and me ordinarily. He told corny jokes in a southern theatrical style, could do card tricks and magic tricks, could detach his thumb and replace it, make a handkerchief disappear and come back. He could play boogie-woogie piano and sometimes would talk Dixie to us, and sometimes like Amos and Andy. He'd lost some of his hearing by flying the Mitchells and was sensitive about it. But he looked sharp in his honest GI haircut and blue captain's tunic and generally conveyed a warmth that was genuine and made my twin sister and me love him. It was also probably the reason my mother had been attracted to him, though they couldn't have been more unsuited and different, and unluckily gotten pregnant from their one hasty encounter after meeting at a party honoring returned airmen near where he was retraining to learn supply officer duties at Fort Lewis in March 1945, when no one needed him to drop bombs anymore. They were married immediately when they found out. Her parents, who lived in Tacoma, were Jewish immigrants from Poland, didn't approve. They were educated mathematics teachers and semi-professional musicians and popular concertizers in Poznan who'd escaped after 1918 and came to Washington State through Canada and became, of all things, school custodians. Being Jews meant little to them by then. Or to our mother, just an old, exacting, constricted conception of life they were happy to put behind them in a land where there apparently were no Jews. But for their only daughter to marry a smiling, talkative, only son of Scotch-Irish backwoods timber estimators was never in their thinking, and they soon put it out of their thinking altogether, and while from a distance it may seem that our parents were merely not made for one another, it was more true that when our mother married our father, it betokened a loss, and her life changed forever, and not in a good way, as she surely must have believed. My mother, Neva Camper, short for Geneva, was a tiny, intense, bespectacled woman with unruly brown hair, downy vestiges of which ran down her jawline. She had thick eyebrows and a shiny, thin-skinned forehead under which her veins were visible, and a pale indoor complexion that made her appear fragile, which she wasn't. My father jokingly said people where he was from in Alabama called her hair Jew hair or immigrant hair, but he liked it and loved her. She never seemed to pay these words much attention. She had small, delicate hands whose nails she kept manicured and shined and was vain about and gestured with absently. She owned a skeptical frame of mind, was an intent listener when we talked to her, and had a wit that could be that could turn biting. She wore frameless glasses, read French poetry, often used terms like cauchemar or trou de coule, which my sister and I didn't understand. She wrote poems in brown ink bought through the mail and kept a journal we weren't permitted to read and normally had a slightly nose-elevated, astigmatized expression of perplexity which became true of her and may always have been true. Before she married my father and quickly had my sister and me, she'd graduated at 18 from Whitman College in Walla Walla, had worked in a bookstore, featured herself possibly as a bohemian and a poet, and had hoped someday to land a job as a studious small college instructor married to someone different from who she did marry, conceivably a college professor, which would have given her the life she believed she was intended for. She was only 34 in 1960, the year these events occurred. But she already had serious lines beside her nose, which was small and pinkish at its tip, and her large, penetrating gray-green eyes had dusky lids that made her seem foreign and slightly sad and dissatisfied, which she was. She possessed a pretty thin neck and a sudden, unexpected smile that showed off her small teeth and girlish, heart-shaped mouth, though it was a smile she rarely practiced except on my sister and me. We realized she was an unusual-looking person, dressed as she typically was, in olive-color slacks and baggy sleeve cotton blouses and hempen cotton shoes she must have sent away to the West Coast for, since you couldn't buy such things in Great Falls. And she only seemed more unusual, standing reluctantly beside our tall, handsome, outgoing father, though it was rarely the case that we went out as a family or ate in restaurants, so that we hardly noticed how they appeared in the world among strangers. To us, life in our house seemed normal. My sister and I could easily see why my mother would have been attracted to Bev Parsons, big plank-shouldered, talkative, funny, forever wanting to please anybody who came in range. But it was never completely obvious why he would take an interest in her, tiny, barely 5 feet, inward and shy, alienated, artistic, pretty only when she smiled and witty only when she felt completely comfortable. He must have somehow just appreciated all that, sensed she had a subtler mind than his, but that he could please her, which made him happy. It was to his good credit that he looked beyond their physical differences to the heart of things human, which I admired, even if it wasn't in our mother to notice. Still, the odd union of their mismatched physical attributes always plays in my mind as part of the reason they ended up badly. They were no doubt simply wrong for each other and should never have married or done any of it, should have gone their separate ways after their first passionate encounter, no matter its outcome. The longer they stayed on, and the better they knew each other, the better she at least could see their mistake, and the more misguided their lives became, like a long proof in mathematics, in which the first calculation is wrong, following which all other calculations move you further away from how things were when they made sense. A sociologist of those times, the beginning of the 60s, might say our parents were in the vanguard of an historical moment where among the first who transgressed society's boundaries, embraced rebellion, believed in credos requiring ratification through self-destruction, but they weren't. They weren't reckless people in the vanguard of anything. They were, as I said, regular people, tricked by circumstance and bad instincts, along with bad luck, to venture outside of boundaries they knew to be right, and then found themselves unable to go back. Though I'll say this about my father. When he returned from the theater of war and from being the agent of whistling death out of the skies, it was 1945, the year my sister and I were born in Michigan at the Wirt Smith Base in Oscoda, he may have been in the grip of some great unspecified gravity, as many GIs were. He spent the rest of his life wrestling with that gravity, puzzling to stay positive and afloat, making his decisions that truly seemed good for a moment, but ultimately misunderstanding the world he'd returned home to and having that misunderstanding become his life. Again, it must have been that way for millions of boys, although he would never have known about it, or he would never have known about it himself or admitted it was true. Our family came to a stop in Great Falls, Montana in 1956, the way many military families came to where they came to following the war. We'd lived on air bases in Mississippi and California and Texas. Our mother had her degree and did substitute teaching in all those places. Our father hadn't been deployed to Korea, but been assigned to desk jobs at home in the supply and requisition forces. He'd been allowed to stay in because he'd won combat ribbons, but hadn't advanced beyond captain. And at a certain point, which happened when we were in Great Falls and he was 37, he decided the Air Force was no longer offering him much of a future, and having put in 20 years, he ought to take his pension and muster out. He felt our mother's lack of social interests and her unwillingness to invite anyone from the base to our house for dinner may have held him back, and possibly he was right. In truth, I think if there'd been someone she admired, she might have liked it. But she never thought there would be. "It's just cows and wheat out here," she said. "There's no real organized society." In any case, I think our father was tired of the Air Force and liked Great Falls as a place where he thought he could get ahead, even without a social life. He said he hoped to join the Masons. It was by then the spring of 1960. My sister Berner and I were 15. We were enrolled in the Lewis from Meriwether Lewis Junior High, which was near enough to the Missouri River that from the tall school windows, I could see the shining river surface and the ducks and birds congregated there, and could glimpse the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Depot, where passenger trains no longer stopped, and up to the municipal airport on Gore Hill, where there were two flights a day, and down the river to the smelter stack in the oil refinery above the falls the city took its name from. I could even on clear days see the hazy, snowy peaks of the Eastern Front, 60 miles away, running south toward Idaho and north up to Canada. My sister and I had no idea about the West, except what we saw on TV, or even, for that matter, about America itself, which we took for granted as the best place to be. Our real life was the family, and we were part of its loose baggage. And because of our mother's growing alienation, her reclusiveness, her feeling of superiority, and her desire that Berner and I not assimilate into the market town mentality, which she believed stifled life in Great Falls, we didn't have a life like most children, which might have involved friends to visit, a paper route, scouts, and dances. If we fit in, our mother felt, it would only increase the chance that we'd end up right where we were. It was also true that if your father was at the base, no matter where you lived, you always had few friends and rarely met your neighbors. We did everything at the base. Visited the doctor, the dentist, got haircuts, shopped for groceries. People knew that. They knew you wouldn't be where you were for long, so why bother taking the trouble to know you? The base carried a stigma, as if things that went on there were what proper people didn't need to know about or be associated with. Plus, my mother being Jewish and having an immigrant look and being in some ways bohemian, it was something we all talked about, as if protecting America from its enemies wasn't decent. Still, at least in the beginning, I liked Great Falls. It was called the Electric City because the falls produced power. It seemed rough-edged and upright and remote, yet still was a part of the limitless country we'd already lived in. I didn't much like it that the streets only had numbers for names, which was confusing, and my mother said meant it was a town laid out by pinch-penny bankers. And of course, the winters were frozen and tireless, and the wind hurtled down out of the north like a freight train, and the loss of light would have made anybody demoralized, even the most optimistic of souls. In truth, though, Berner and I never thought of ourselves as being from anywhere in particular. Each time our family moved to a new place, any of the far-flung locales, and settled ourselves into a rented house, and our father put on his pressed blue uniform and drove off to work at some airbase, and my mother commenced a new teaching position, Berner and I would try to think that this was where we'd say we were from if anyone asked. We practiced saying the words to each other on our way to whatever our new school was each time. Hello, we're from Biloxi, Mississippi. Hello, I'm from Oscoda. It's way up in Michigan. Hello, I live in Victorville. I tried to learn the basic things the other boys knew and to talk the way they talked, pick up the slang expressions, walk around as though I felt confident being there and couldn't be surprised. Berner did the same. Then we'd move away to some other place, and Berner and I would try to get situated all over again. This kind of growing up, I know, can leave you either cast out and adrift, or else it can encourage you to be malleable and dedicated to adjusting, the thing my mother disapproved of since she didn't do it, and held out for herself some notion of a different future, more like the one she'd imagined before she met our father. We, my sister and I, were small players in a drama she saw to be relentlessly unfolding. As a result, what I began to care greatly about was school, which was the continual thread in life besides my parents and my sister. I never wanted school to be over. I'd spend as much time inside school as I could, poring over books we were given, being around the teachers, breathing in the school odors, which were the same everywhere and like no other. Knowing things became important to me, no matter what they were. Our mother knew things and appreciated them. I wanted to be like her in that way, since I could keep the things I knew, and they would characterize me as being well-rounded and promising characteristics that were important to me. No matter if I didn't belong in any of those places, I did belong in their schools. I was good at English and history and science and math, subjects my mother was also good at. Each time we picked up and moved, the only fact of life that made moving frightening was that for some reason I wouldn't be allowed to return to school, or I would miss some crucial knowledge that could assure my future and was obtainable nowhere else, or that would go to some new place where there would be no school for me at all. Guam was once discussed. I feared I'd end up knowing nothing, have nothing to rely on that could distinguish me. I'm sure it was all an inheritance from my mother's feelings of an unrewarded life, though it may also have been that our parents, a swirl in the thickening confusion of their own young lives, not being made for each other, probably not physically desiring each other as they briefly had, becoming rapidly only satellites of each other, and coming eventually to resent one another without completely realizing it, didn't offer my sister and me enough to hold on to, which is what parents are supposed to do. However, blaming your parents for your life's difficulties finally leads nowhere. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're kind to come tonight. Let me pour myself a glass of water. Sorry about the vision issue. I didn't realize I couldn't see till about 10 minutes in, and I thought, I can't see. But I'm old, you know. You never know what your eyes are going to do when you get old. There's some mornings I wake up in the morning and I can see great. There's some mornings I wake up and I can't see anything. Even putting my glasses on doesn't help. So, you know, it's great, isn't it? 68. If anybody has a question, I'd be happy to try. Yes, sir, please.
Does your emphasis on the mother reflect the losing of your father when you were fairly young?
Well, the question was, does the emphasis on the mother in this novel reflect the fact that I lost my father when I was 16? Probably it is the case that I understood, because my father died when I was 16, that that was a big moment of transition in my life. And one of the things that makes novelists be novelists is a conviction that everything that happens to me also happens to everybody else. And so I guess I hatched that conviction that it was a transition time for me when I left vestiges of childhood somewhat behind and had sort of forced into the vestiges of, you know, the beginning of adulthood. So, yeah, in that way, I saw that life moment as transitional. And I did live with my mother after my father was gone. But in fact, the whole of the book pretty well treats the mother and the father fairly equally. They both go to jail. They rob a bank and get put in prison for it. Yes, sir, please.
I'm as fascinated by the differences between Canada and the United States as I am the similarities. And I'm wondering if you chose Canada for a particular reason and what you thought about Canada and what it represents to you.
Well, I couldn't go across the border to France. Canada was a country of opportunity to some extent. I hatched the notion of this book living in a little wheat prairie town in central Montana. But I should repeat the question. The gentleman just asked if Canada meant something special to me as a subject for this book, because the speaker of this book, Del Parsons, when his parents are thrust into jail, is forced to go across into Saskatchewan to live with strangers. When I thought of the idea for the book, it was about a boy who was for some reason abandoned by his parents and who was pushed across the border into Saskatchewan. And I had been to Saskatchewan a lot living in central Montana, and it had a real palpable sort of suppleness for me. It had for me Canada, that landscape, and even the word itself, Canada, had for me what Catherine Ann Porter calls a commotion. When I went up there, something just was zinging around inside of me, and that's a cue to me that I should set something there, and it may even be a cue to me that Canada be a subject for this book, which to some extent it is. I always felt, living in Montana, which is an exigent place. Montana is just banging on you all the time, banging on you all the time. And actually, America, when you live outside of America, one of the things you come to understand is that America is banging on you all the time. It's always just pushing everybody's rights and privileges in everybody else's face. And it's not like that everywhere in the world. And one of the places it's not like that is in Canada. And I liked that. It seemed to me to be a place of certain kinds of affirmations. People seemed more tolerant. Now, there will be people who are Canadians who will say, well, you're wrong. That Canada is just as exigent as America is. You just don't know it. It's just the other side of the border, so it seems better to you. But once again, I had to go on my own instincts. I had, the day after W was elected the second time, if you can remember that dark day, I was not able to get a flu shot in Montana, so I got in my car and I drove across up into Saskatchewan to East End, to Saskatchewan, and I got a flu shot. They were happy to give me a flu shot. They didn't care. They didn't want me to die. But I remember driving across the border, driving up from Harlem, Montana, straight north up to the climax. It's the border crossing at Climax, Saskatchewan. And when I got across the border, I just felt the weight of the world lift off of me. I thought, I am somewhere where this man is not the president. And I thought, I have to do something with my life to celebrate this in some way. So then, in some ways, given the whole circuitry of this, this novel is a kind of a pay-in to Canada, in a sense. Yes, sir, please.
This is probably a big stretch, but I couldn't help but think when you were reading that the name Dell is slightly unusual, and it made you think of the character Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird. I wondered if that was intentional.
It was not. The question was, is my character, whose name is Dell, akin to a character in To Kill a Mockingbird? And no, not that I know of. I mean, everything you read in your life takes up some kind of residence, you know. You think you have invented something out of whole cloth, and comes to be that it resonates with something long ago that you had read or that I had read and forgotten. And if that is the case, I did not know it. I mean, it, very, very peculiar for me. When I wrote The Sports Writer back in the 80s, Frank Bascom's name when I wrote the book was Frank Slocum, because I wanted to sort of model Frank on Joshua Slocum, the first man that we know of to sail single-handedly around the world. And so when I showed my book to Donald Hall, who was one of my teachers at Michigan, he said, well, this is fine, he said, but you can't call him Frank Slocum. I said, well, why not? He said, because Joe Heller's book, Something Happened, is narrated by someone named Slocum. And I loved that book of Heller's, and I had completely eradicated that name from that book and put my own needs first. So just at the time I was getting ready to publish that book, I had to change the character's name. And so I remember sitting in our little house in Princeton, going through names that had two syllables and had the right sort of vowel sounds, and came up with Bascom, which I have... perfectly happy with. It seems odd that you can change the name of a character just before the book goes into existence and get used to it, but I did. You know, go figure. I don't understand that very well, because you get so married to names of characters. No, Dell just came out of my fervid little brain, just like his sister Berner's name came out of my fervid little brain. I don't know where they came from. Yes, ma'am. Please.
I recently read Warren Moore's article about you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
And I was particularly intrigued by the quotation from John Rustin that composition is the arrangement of unequal things.
Yes.
Which apparently comes at the beginning of the book and the end of the book.
Yes, it does.
And
Lady's question was that in, I haven't read Laurie's review because I don't read reviews. But my wife read it and she told me that I don't have to wince about it. But Laurie made some reference to a line in this book, which is a quote from John Ruskin, and the quote is that composition is the arrangement of unequal things. And that when I read that line, I read it reading Ruskin in Modern Painters. It just was one of those lines that just leapt off the page at me when I read it. I just thought, wow, is that smart? And because it was so basic about what composition is, because for me, that's exactly what composition is, that you're in an almost mosaical way putting together things, some of which are large and some of which are small and some of which don't fit and some of which do. And so you're always kind of trying to fit and work things in together, which seemed to me to be what composition probably is for most people, even if their habits and practices aren't mine. And so it seemed important to put that in this book, in part to establish the sort of plausibility that this book is told by an adult at a time, about a time when he was a teenager. And it seemed to be one of those kind of, for me, plush lines that if I put it in my book, it'll always sort of, it'll attract things to it. And then, lo and behold, as happens when you're lucky writing a novel, and you have to be lucky to write a novel, as David can tell you, anybody who's written a novel knows you have to be lucky. When I came around to the end of the book, there it was again, asking to be put in the book, which was a very hopeful sign, because what it meant to me at that point was that what I thought I was doing at the beginning of the book was, in fact, the book I was finishing when I got to the end. Novels kind of talk to you that way in a sense. If you work on them hard and you concentrate really hard, they will begin to sort of organize your world for you. And that is the case with this book. So that's why I put it in. I also, I just thought it was smart. I thought maybe it would make me look smart. Yes, sir, please. A gentleman asked if I would say something about Eudora, and then if I would say something about my own writing habits. Eudora was the most wonderful person in the world. She was. David and I were talking about her before this evening commenced. She was so mirthful. She had a completely interactive relationship with the animate and inanimate world. So that if you were walking someplace with her, she'd say, "Oh, look at that dog! I wonder what he's thinking." And sometimes it would see a little. She would be a little loopy, but she wasn't loopy. She just saw the world as in constant sort of contact with herself, and she was a great friend, a wonderful, loyal friend to writers. I grew up. In the house across the street from where she grew up, she and I went to the same grade school and had the same teachers. If you can believe that, she was 35 years older than I. But I remember one time, the grade school that she lived across the street from and I lived next door to had its 70th anniversary. And the people who were then running the school, it was a magnet school by this time. When we went there, it was just all little white kids, of course. Now it was many races going there, which was wonderful. And so they had Eudora and me come back to sort of be there. And it was an arrangement like this out on the playground. And Eudora and I were sitting in two chairs, sort of facing the crowd. I don't know. I think we were supposed to say something. I don't remember if we did. But Eudora leaned over to me, and at this time she was about 85. She leaned over to me and she said, "Look who's in the front row." She had a very deep voice. And I looked in the front row, and there was Miss Varnadoe. Miss Varnadoe had been her teacher. She had been the principal when I had gone to school there, and she was a million years old.
And she was kind of sitting there, sort of slumped to the side like that. And her niece had brought her there because she had been the teacher in that school from the day it opened. And there she was at its 70th anniversary. And so we went over and talked to her. It was quite wonderful. She was at that time 95, something like that. But and I can remember Eudora putting her hand up and said, "Look who's in the front row." As if, you know, there's nothing we could do to get away from her. My work habits are simple. I'm a guy who works all day, at least parts of all day, and get up in the morning at 6 o'clock and go to work at 8:30. Work from 8:30 till around 12:30, and have lunch, take a nap, go back to work about 3:15, and work till 5, and write with a pen. I have a boathouse down below where we live in Maine, and it's fixed up where I can work in it summer and winter. It doesn't have a toilet. It doesn't have water or anything. It doesn't have heat, but it has a stove that I feed, and it's a great place to work. Nothing happens down there. There's no phone. There's no radio. There's no nothing. It's just a quiet place to work. And when I'm not working down there, if I'm not writing a book, then my wife, I give it to her, or we share it. And then she wrote a book down there for Yale a year and a half ago. It's just the two of us. So she's a writer, and that's life. I go to work, but I try not to make what I do be the kind of work, sort of slavish work, that I would have probably done if I had done something else, if I'd been a lawyer or if I'd stayed in the Marines or something like that. I try to make it be not a terrible hardship, because I don't work very well when I'm tired, and just try to make it be a life that I can be happy doing for long periods of time. Because when I'm writing a book, I work 365 days a year, Christmas morning, Easter morning, Thanksgiving morning, New Year's morning. I work all those days. And then for a while, I'll take a couple of years off. So that's just how it is. I mean, you know, writing novels is not rocket science. You know, George Will, a fellow Michigan State graduate, but there's where our similarities end. He said something once that was really smart. He said, talent is a species of vigor. And that's what I am. I am vigorous, and I am relentless. And talent I never thought I had any of. But I just thought, I'm going to do this and do this and do this until I can't do it anymore. And so that's brought me to here today. One more question, and then we'll stop. Please, sir.
Could you have set this book in 1950 after the war, or in 1980 after Vietnam? Or why did you choose 60?
Well, I chose 60, probably because I was 15 and 16 in 1960, and I sort of knew the lay of the land there. I sort of knew how that moment felt. You know, Walker Percy, Joe Heller, and Dick Yates all published wonderful novels in 1960. They published Revolutionary Road, the Moviegoer, and Catch 22. And for me, that was an immense watershed in American life when those great novels were published. And in a way, particularly Walker's book, the Moviegoer, was about the transition from a mentality which is identifiable now to us as a 50s mentality in the commencement of the 60s. If you read that book on those historical terms, it makes a lot of sense. And so I just thought, you know, 60 was pivotal. Lives are changing. People's attitudes are beginning to seem from before no longer workable in the future. That's why I chose it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.